Item number 14.
Right.
Okay. Staff recommendation for an updated conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for discharges from irrigated lands. Draft order number R3-2011-0006. Time for...
Yeah, you should read that first.
Okay. This is the time and place for a public hearing to consider adoption of a waiver of waste discharge requirements for discharges of waste from irrigated lands. This hearing is being held before a panel of members of the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. I am Jeff Young, Chair of the Regional Board. Also serving on the panel are Russell Jeffries to my right and Monica Hunter and David Hodgen to my left. For your information, board members John Hayashi and Dr. Jean-Pierre Wolf have a conflict and may not participate in this matter as board member in accordance with state law. The official record of the testimony at this hearing will be created by our court reporter. We are also using a tape recorder and videotape recording today, but the recordings will not be the official record of the hearing. At the end of this hearing today, I will close the record in this matter, and this panel will discuss and arrive at a proposed recommended decision. This panel will make a recommendation that will be presented to the regional board at a future meeting when the board has a quorum that can act on this matter. You will be notified of the date and location of that hearing. At that time, the full board may adopt, reject, or modify the recommendation of this panel. Absent extraordinary circumstances, you will not have another opportunity to provide argument or evidence to the full board. Thus, you are encouraged to present today all the evidence that you would like this panel or the full board to consider. If anyone in the audience wishes to address the panel today, please promptly fill out a speaker card and hand it to the clerk. To allow time for board panel deliberation, I will limit the time for speakers if necessary. I have allowed extra time to those persons who have requested extra time in advance as set forth in the public notice for this item. The rest of the public will have up to 3 minutes, but it may be less depending on the number of speakers. If you wish to speak, please submit a speaker card that are available at the back of the room. I will accept speaker cards until noon. Following the lunch break, I will announce the account of time I will be able to allocate to public speakers. Please summarize your comments and avoid repetition. The board members have fully reviewed the written submittals and will consider all comments. The hearing will proceed as follows. Regional board staff will go first, followed by elected officials. They'll have 3 minutes each. The Farm Bureau panel will have 55 minutes. California Strawberry Commission will have 15 minutes. Coast Keeper will have 24 minutes. Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, 12 minutes. Coastal Alliance, 8 minutes. Channel Keeper, 12 minutes. Central Coast Alliance for Sustainable Economy, 8 minutes. And then we'll have public comments and we'll see whether we have few enough people that everyone would have 3 minutes, or am I going to have to cut that back down? I won't know at this point. Closing statement of the Farm Bureau, 5 minutes. After the conclusion of testimony and comments, staff will be provided an opportunity to summarize and make a recommendation. A timer will be used to allow for the orderly conduct of the hearing. I request that you end your comments when your time is complete. We will begin with staff's presentation. Mr. Briggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those times that Chair Young just listed add up to about 2 hours and 20 minutes, I believe. And with the staff presentation, that, and even without interruption of those times for board questions and answers, that will take us pretty close to noon. So it looks like our individual speakers will be in the afternoon. And I want to make a couple other announcements since we're getting a pretty good sized crowd here. For those folks that are standing in the back, there are a lot of seats available. I see seats here and seats over here. So unless you want to stand, there are seats available. And if we do get filled up, and if folks don't want to stand in the back, we have the room next door, and I understand there's audio available over there. So and actually, if you folks and staff could help out, if we do get people coming in, obviously after this announcement, if you could let them know that that's available, we'd appreciate that. Also, the City of Watsonville, whose facility we're using today, and I should have introduced Erwin, who's helping us out down here in the City of Watsonville. The city has waived their parking fee for today, so now we tell you. I was hoping there was a little sign on the machine down there, but maybe not. Anyway, that's thank you for making your donation to the City of Watsonville. And let's see. That's it for logistics. So as Chair Young said, this item that we have today, and by the way, we had the rest of our board meeting with our other items yesterday afternoon so that we could devote the day today as much time as is necessary to this one item, this very important item. So like I said, make sure you get your testimony cards in. And as the chair said, we'll cut those off at noon. So again, if you could help out with that, if people come in and sit next to you, you might mention that to them in case they get by without getting a testimony card. This item for updating this order for irrigated ag is a process that we actually started about 2.5 years ago. And in trying to formulate a process for that, we sent out our first letter on it in December of 2008, I think it was. That's 2.5 years ago. And so I won't go through the whole process. Actually, Lisa McCann is going to talk about the process that we've used a little bit in the presentation. But I just wanted to point out this has been a very lengthy process. The board itself has had two large formal workshops, one in the north, one in the south, an additional workshop at the regular board meeting in February, a huge amount of comments, and a lot of changes in the orders we've gone along in terms of what we have draft today. So we'll be getting into the details of that. But today's meeting is consistent with the schedule that we discussed late last year in terms of how we would roll this out. And that was discussed in the board meetings with the board and with the public. And so we're on track in terms of what we said we would be doing. With consideration today, the kind of fly in the ointment is that we don't have a quorum today. So today's meeting is being held as a panel hearing of the board. And then once we have a full board with a quorum, the recommendations of the panel would go to the full board. The new board member or members would review the record in order to be able to vote on the item. This issue is unique, really, in terms of the typical items that we deal with, and it's unique in terms of the number of parties, although we do have programs that have actually thousands of parties, whether it's the underground tanks program or the stormwater program. But it's unique in terms of the water quality issues, groundwater, as well as many aspects of surface water and the variation in the practices that are involved with agriculture, with the different climate, soil crops, and all those sorts of variables. So it is kind of unique in terms of the scope that we have to deal with, both in terms of what's happening on the ground and then what's appropriate in terms of a regulatory framework. Because of that, the broadness of the issue, we have several staff here today because over this 2.5 years, we've had several staff who have dealt with various aspects of this very broad issue and have different levels of expertise. And so we decided it would be a good idea for those staff to join us today and, if necessary, to provide more detailed answers to questions, then they will be available. So those those staff are, I already mentioned Harvey Packard. He's supervising water resource control engineer and our enforcement coordinator. Karen Worster is our environmental scientist who manages our ambient monitoring program, and CCAMP, Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. Of course, we've relied a lot on CCAMP data and then subsequent and concurrent cooperative monitoring program data for our water quality information for this program. Karen's right, Lar. Matt Keeling is a water resource control engineer in our permitting unit. He's been working on groundwater quality monitoring and reporting. That's right there. Dean Thomas has worked in our groundwater cleanup program, and he's here about groundwater quality and reporting. He's right there. Monica Baracarte, oh, you're hiding behind Karen. Water resource control engineer, works in our agricultural regulatory program, so she works in the program full-time. And she's worked on nitrate load reduction, irrigation, and nutrient management. Dominic Rock, is Dominic here? There's Dominic. Is engineering geologist, works in our stormwater program, focusing on hydromodification and riparian protection issues. And he's available for questions about the cost information that we developed. Jill North is seated next to Dominic, environmental scientist, and she is here on the riparian and aquatic habitat protection issues. Shanta Keeling, over on the end, water resource control engineer in our total maximum daily load, or TMDL, unit, and she worked on the CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act documents. And then additionally, Hector Hernandez is in the back of the room. Corinne Huckabee. There's Corinne. Steve Size in the back. They're helping out with information management and other logistics. Both Hector and Hector Hernandez and Harvey Packard can assist Spanish-speaking members of the public. And I haven't verified this, but I understand our translators will also be available to assist at the podium if that's necessary. So for our presentation today, in terms of staff presentation, Michael Thomas is going to be providing the opening remarks. And do we have, we do have something on the screen. That's good. Having a little trouble getting that going. Michael is an engineer with the board who has worked for the board since 1985 and has worked in both surface and groundwater issues, including issues having to do with agricultural impacts, notably in the Elkhorn Slough watershed area. And he's going to be starting off. Lisa McCann is actually third up, but Lisa is she's seated next to Michael. She's our environmental program manager and manages our watershed protection and planning section, and that section includes stormwater, riparian and wetlands protection, regional monitoring, assessment, and planning. And she's been working with our board since 1995. She worked in the Morro Bay watershed and in Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Agriculture and Rural Lands Plan programs. She's also worked on many erosion control, irrigation, and nutrient management best management practices. She became our region's non-point source program manager and led the development of many total maximum daily load plans. These programs and activities involve working with agriculturalists to improve water quality information, management practices to reduce pollution loading, and to establish more accountable regulatory options. And lately she's been co-managing development of this order with Angela Schroeder. So Angela is seated next to her. She's a senior engineering geologist. She manages our agricultural regulatory program within Lisa's section. She came to the board in 2006 from the state board and has managed the grants program and worked with the TMDL program. She worked for 10 years at the state board where she developed and managed the groundwater ambient monitoring assessment program, or GAMA, and worked in several groundwater regulatory programs. And like I said, we're going to be starting off with Michael Thomas, who's going to provide the opening remarks and the overview. That'll be followed by Angela with a brief summary of the order and what it entails. Lisa's going to cover public comments and responses, and then Michael will provide our preliminary conclusion at this point. Michael Thomas.
Thank you, Roger. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. One of the things that has come up over and over again in the past 2.5 years as we've been working on this project is this concept of fairness. And what fairness means depends on who you're talking to. Some people believe that fairness is recognizing that every individual is unique and that everyone should be treated as a unique individual. Other people say that fairness is treating everyone the same. It also depends on who you are. If you're a farmer struggling to make a living today in this environment of increasing regulations from multiple agencies like ours, or if you are a fisherman who's like this photograph here is someone who's fishing in Osoflago Lake. That lake is now posted because of the contamination in fish tissue due to pesticides. Or if you're a person who's relying on groundwater as a drinking water source and that water is contaminated, the picture can look very different. So we have a lot of stakeholders involved in this process with very divergent views, much more so than on many of our other projects, most of our other projects, and much more so than when the board adopted the 2004 conditional waiver. And that is by design. We have tried to bring as many stakeholders into this process as possible. But in doing that, we obviously raised this issue of fairness, and more controversy comes to the surface because of that. So for context, I wanted to talk to the board about relative degree of regulation. What are we actually talking about here compared to other programs? And I think you've seen this graph before. We've showed it to the board before, so I wanted to just remind you of this. So as far as a relative degree of regulation, timber harvesting is one of the least regulated programs that we have as far as degree of regulation or comprehensiveness of the regulations. And it's decreasing. That arrow indicates that our direction as far as oversight of timber harvesting has been decreasing over the past several years. Urban stormwater is more comprehensive in terms of our oversight and regulations, and that has been increasing over the past several years, as you know, because the board has spent so much time on it. Municipal wastewater is one of the most highly regulated activities that this board oversees. Drinking water pollution cases are also heavily regulated. For obvious reasons, they present a major threat to public health. Landfills are also heavily regulated. So, in comparison, the 2004 conditional waiver is at the low end of this scale. When you compare the requirements or the conditions in the 2004 conditional waiver to all of the board's other programs, it is one of the least comprehensive or the least burdensome of our regulations. And we also have to look at the relative degree of water quality impacts from these different activities. Timber harvesting is very low because of the way it's done in our region. In other regions, there are major impacts, environmental impacts due to timber harvesting, but here it's relatively low because of the type of timber harvesting that is done. It's very selective. Landfills represent a medium threat to water quality today because of the regulation that the board has imposed. For instance, all landfills have to be designed, they have to have adequate caps, they have to have adequate lining. Municipal wastewater also has a medium degree of water quality impact compared to other programs, again, because of the degree of regulation. There are some serious issues associated with municipal wastewater, like emerging contaminants of concern, such as endocrine disruptors. Urban stormwater presents a relatively high threat to water quality. We're seeing whole watershed impacts or potential impacts from urban stormwater, and that is why we are increasing our regulation and oversight. Drinking water pollution cases, even though they're heavily regulated, they still represent a major water quality impact and human health threat. Irrigated agriculture on this scale is at the top of the scale. The water quality impacts due to irrigated agriculture are the most serious and severe impacts that we deal with as an agency. So the question now is, where does the 2011 draft order fall into place here on that top scale? Falls into place here. Tier, as you know, the order has three tiers, and each tier has a different degree of regulation. Tier one is the least, tier two is in the middle, tier three is the highest. Tier one is slightly less than the 2004 conditional waiver. Tier two is similar to the 2004 waiver, but has some additional requirements, and we're going to be talking about those, and those are highly controversial. Tier three has more significant requirements because those dischargers represent the greatest threat and greatest impact to water quality. So it's important to realize where that 2011 order is. I imagine if you're on the receiving end of it, it does not seem like you're at the lower end of this scale. It seems like you're at the other upper end of this scale. But compared to our... Because of the microphone or because they're talking? Okay. Okay, so that's the context. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the water quality problems we have in our region. We do have some of the most severe pollution in the United States here on the Central Coast. And the information and the realization of this pollution is not new. The report was published in 1988 by the Monterey County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. It's called Nitrates in Groundwater, Salinas, California. And it concludes some significant, or it has some significant conclusions. One is that nitrate contamination poses a substantial threat to this industry. The report talked at length about nitrate contamination in groundwater. And these are quotes from this report. They also concluded that drinking water is considered the highest beneficial use of water. That should sound familiar. That's our agency agrees with that, and that's one of our highest priorities. Nitrate removal from drinking water supplies is costly, and we agree. That's documented in our staff report and in the order. And the state maintains a non-degradation policy. If additional wells go out of production, the nitrate situation will become critical. And it is anticipated that additional regulations will be imposed. They also conclude that specific actions are needed to mitigate existing problems and to reduce the potential for future problems. And the situation will merit a dedicated effort and special attention by the leadership in the county and around the state. If it is ignored, it will not go away. So back in 1988, we recognized, and other agencies recognized, the significance of this pollution problem. And I think that first quote is one of the most important, where they're saying that nitrate contamination poses a substantial threat to the industry itself. And I think the industry is aware of that and has become much more aware of that over the past few years. Fast forward over 20 years, and this is the condition that we have today in the lower Salinas Valley with respect to public water supply wells. Pie chart, I'm sorry that you can't see the red very well on this screen that the public is looking at, but it shows that 23% of the wells in the lower Salinas Valley are contaminated with nitrates, and another 37% are affected by nitrates. The 37% that's in yellow here, the concentration of nitrate is just below the drinking water standard, and it is increasing. This underestimates the actual threat to drinking water supplies, because these wells tend to be deeper wells. They're not the domestic wells that are in shallow water. In the Santa Maria area, we have the same situation. 27% of the water supply wells are contaminated with nitrate. And by the way, this water has to be treated before it's provided to the public and is treated. So from these wells, people are not drinking contaminated water. That water has to be treated or blended. 40% of the wells are just below the drinking water standard, and those concentrations are rising. Many of these wells that you see in red here on both these maps, on the Salinas map and the Santa Maria map, have been abandoned, and they've had to drill new wells to deal with this nitrate problem. As I said, that data underestimates the problem. Domestic wells pull from shallow water, and we have over 44,000 domestic wells on the Central Coast. Many of these domestic wells are in irrigated ag areas where we have these high concentrations of nitrate and groundwater. We don't know how many people are currently drinking contaminated water from these wells, but this is our highest priority, staff's highest priority, and this is something that we are taking action on right now. I think you heard a little bit about this yesterday. Some of the actions that we're taking, we're identifying the high-risk areas. We've actually have identified the high-risk areas. We are currently identifying homeowners in those areas so that we can send notices to them about the threat to water quality and options that they have for dealing with it, including treating, or getting treatment for their own water and sampling for their own water. We're also developing a well testing program to help the homeowners get their water tested so they know what the quality is. And we're also pursuing alternative water cases, meaning we're in areas where we know there are high levels of contamination in shallow groundwater where people are using that water. We're looking at the sources, and in the future we'll be bringing cases to the board where we'll be recommending that the responsible parties provide alternative water to the homeowners, as the board has done in other drinking water contamination cases. The human health impacts due to nitrate are serious. You've heard about blue baby syndrome before. That's well documented. There's also growing evidence of other risks, including cancer, thyroid inhibition, Parkinson's, diabetes, and endocrine system disruption. The costs are astronomical in terms of treating nitrates. Water purveyors, we've met with water purveyors, and they've talked to us about the costs that they are having to deal with in the millions of dollars for small communities. And the water purveyors are routinely going to the Public Utilities Commission and asking for rate increases to deal with the treatment or the need to drill new wells. So they have to pass the cost on to the users. Now I'm going to switch to surface water, talk about that, the conditions of surface water briefly. This is a map of the Monterey area. You see the Elkhorn Slough, Castroville, and Salinas River, and the Reclamation Ditch. In the old Salinas River area, which is here, we have some of the highest concentrations of nitrate in surface water for any river or lagoon system known in the literature. And they're increasing. They've been increasing for the past several decades. They've been increasing over the past decade. The Elkhorn Slough area is heavily impacted by nitrates and eutrophication and cascading biological impacts that occur there because of the nutrients coming into the slough. There was a report published in 1996 by the Elkhorn Slough Foundation and the Elkhorn Slough Estuarine Research Reserve, and their conclusion was that in 1996 that there has been a significant increase in nitrate concentration since the 70s, and they have extraordinarily high nitrate concentrations in the lower Salinas River, which may be the highest recorded in scientific literature for a river or estuary. And as I mentioned, these concentrations are still increasing. There are multiple organizations monitoring this area. This data is from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, and it shows increasing concentrations from 2004 to 2011. That data is very similar to the Water Board's own data, which we collect through the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. This is the Salinas River showing nitrate concentrations increasing over time. It's the old Salinas River. The red line is the drinking water standard of 10, and you can see the concentrations are over 60 or 5 times the drinking water standard. They're also 50 times the aquatic index standard of 1 milligram per liter. And we see biological impacts where the concentrations in surface waters exceed 1 milligram per liter. So these are 60 times that amount. And it's the same situation in multiple places around our region. This is Quail Creek. You can see concentrations, surface water concentrations of up to 100 milligrams per liter, 10 times the drinking water standard. Natividad Creek, also up almost 100 milligrams per liter. Blanco Drain, over 150 milligrams per liter in some cases. Santa Maria River, moving down south, we also see very high concentrations in the Santa Maria River estuary. Again, around 100 milligrams per liter. Orchid Creek, upstream of Santa Maria River, very high concentrations, some up to 100 milligrams per liter, actually exceeding it in one case. So we have very, very high concentrations of nitrates in the irrigated areas around our region. In addition, this is, again, moving down south, Osoflaco Lake. We have the highest tissue concentration of dieldrin and DDT in the United States, several times higher than the average concentration elsewhere in the United States. We posted that lake for a health warning so that people that are fishing there are aware of that. We have more recent data. I do not have the actual numbers here for you, but there's more recent data showing that we also have problems with currently used pesticides in fish tissue in Osoflaco Lake. We also have ongoing sedimentation and fish tissue contamination in other parts of the state and toxicity problems due to pesticides. 2010 state report on toxicity in California waters shows that the Central Coast streams have the highest percentage of toxic sites statewide. 56% of our sites are toxic, 22% are highly toxic. Highly toxic just means much more toxic than average. And the reason why we have this toxicity, one of the reasons why, is that the amount of chemicals that are used in our region. It is obviously one of the most productive agricultural regions in the world, and that requires the use of chemicals. That yield requires the use of chemicals. A DPR study showed the DPR is the Department of Pesticide Regulation. Their statewide study showed that the Salinas River area had the highest percent of study sites with pyrethroid detections, the highest percentage of sites exceeding toxic levels, and the highest rate of active ingredients applied, 113 pounds per acre, which is three times as much as compared to other areas in the state. We have serious problems with toxicity, but we also have overall water quality problems with surface waters. This is an image from our CCAMP site from Water Board's data, which you can find online. The dark red areas are the most intensely impacted for the list of parameters that you see there: nitrates, orthophosphates, dissolved oxygen, turbidity, nitrates, etc. So it's much more than a toxicity problem. We have an overall biological degradation problem. And the most severely degraded areas coincide with our irrigated agriculture areas. This is why we need to renew the 2004 order. We need to address these water quality problems, and we need to demonstrate tangible improvements in these areas, in the amount of pollution being discharged, and in the concentrations in the receiving waters overall. So reviewing the 2004 conditional waiver, the very first finding of the order is this: the intent of this conditional waiver is to regulate discharges from irrigated lands to ensure that such discharges are not causing or contributing to exceedances of any regional, state, or federal numeric water quality standard. That's not new. That's the first finding in the 2004 order. So the concept of having to comply with water quality standards is not new. This is also in the 2011 proposed order that's in front of you. Finding 16 of the 2004 condition waiver said this: although time will be allowed, increased reporting and monitoring may be required in order to ensure that water quality is improving. That is what we are doing with the 2011 proposed order. Now I'm going to build on the 2004 order. And this is one of the things that people said to us repeatedly. The board said this to us, and many of the stakeholders said to us, is that we should be building on the 2004 order, not simply abandoning it. And we agree. So here is a list of the content of the 2004 order in terms of its conditions and its findings. I already mentioned the 2004 order requires that dischargers meet water quality standards. They also had to file a notice of intent, which is an intent to enroll in the 2004 order, and it describes their farming operation. Dischargers needed to develop a farm plan, and that farm plan had to have several elements: an irrigation management element, a pesticide management element, a nutrient management element, and erosion management element. All had to be included in the farm plan. That is the definition of the farm plan in the 2004 conditional waiver. Farm plan also had to include schedules to implement those management practices. It also included a requirement or a condition to submit a management practice checklist, which was a form submitted to the water board which checked off the management practices that were being implemented at each farm. It also included a requirement for surface water monitoring and a requirement for education. Now I'm going to add a few things to this list, and they'll be in yellow, the yellow text below. Groundwater requirements, backflow prevention, which means modifying a well so that pollution cannot travel back down into the well and contaminate groundwater, and annual compliance information that must be submitted online. Not submitted to the board like this, but submitted to the board online via a form that growers would fill out. And I'll show you that in a few minutes. Now, if you look at the top of this list, it says 2004 conditional waiver. I'm going to change the title. So watch the title. Don't blink or you'll miss it. We're going to change it. This is now Tier 2 of the 2011 order. This is the order that's in front of you today. This is Tier 2. It builds on the 2004 waiver, and we've added some requirements. Notice that the management practice checklist is crossed out. That's no longer part of the order because growers will be submitting information online, specific information in specific fields. They'll be answering specific questions about their actions to implement management practices and the effectiveness of those practices. So if this is Tier 2, what is Tier 3? Tier 3 is Tier 2 plus some additional conditions and requirements. Tier 3 includes a water quality buffer plan for some dischargers, individual monitoring, which means they have to monitor their runoff, an irrigation and nutrient management plan that is more comprehensive than the requirements for Tier 2, and time schedules. We'll be talking about each of these in more detail in a few minutes. Lisa and Angela will be talking about these. So what is Tier 1? Tier 1 is Tier 2 minus the annual compliance info. Growers in Tier 1 do not submit information to the board online in this form that I'll be talking about, which we think is a significant reduction in burden from Tier 2. Tier 1 has approximately 500 growers and about 92,000 acres, which represents 21% of the overall acreage. Tier 2 includes about 1,200 growers, about 25% of the acreage. Tier 3 is about 100 growers, represents 54% of the acreage at about 233,000 acres. This is an illustration of the documentation, the hard copy documentation that growers will have to submit to the Water Board. There aren't any. They will submit no hard copy documents to us. All the information submitted to the board will be online in the form that I'll be showing you. So one of the comments that we've had is that growers would have to produce documents like this by the hundreds or thousands and submit them to the board, and that staff would have to review all of them. Not the case. There will be no hard copies submitted to the board. Information will be submitted online into a database, and we'll be managing the database, which is how we manage programs with many, many growers. We can't do it in this form. It has to be done in a, you'll see that. It has to be done in a database form. So what is the annual compliance form? It is very similar to the notice of intent, the online notice of intent that we developed several months ago that the vast majority of growers have now filled out. They went online, filled out the information, and we now have that database. We will modify that notice of intent depending on what the board adopts. The board adopts the order that is in front of it today. We will modify this form according to the current order, the draft order. If you change the order, we'll modify it according to the changes that you make. But what we will do is add fields with specific questions, and the growers will answer those questions and submit the information under penalty of perjury. There's an example of some of the things that growers will submit to us, the kind of information they will submit on this form online. I'm not going to read all of these to you, but you can see just the type of information that they will submit. So all Tier 2 and Tier 3 dischargers will submit information like the date of the completed farm plan, the type and characteristics of their discharge or discharges, identify direct agricultural discharges to a water body, etc. So they will be submitting the information on having done these things. A subset of Tier 2 and Tier 3 will do photo monitoring and submit that online. They will also submit the information on the total nitrogen applied at their operations. A subset of Tier 3 will, in addition to the items above, submit proof of a certified irrigation and nutrient management plan and elements, and a water quality buffer plan. All of that information will be submitted online in a form like this. We'll have pull-down menus, so it'll be direct and straightforward. You'll answer specific questions and enter the information in response to those questions. And as I mentioned, the form will be the very same type of form as the notice of intent, which we've already developed and the vast majority of growers have already used.
Question for you, Michael, before you switch screens. Are you proposing to have any explanatory material that is connected to the compliance form, like an example of how to estimate acres just discharging to ditches or any other type of surface discharge?
Yes, for example. So there will be a question and then for example. This is the type of information that the grower would provide.
Okay.
Now I'm going to hand it over to Angela Schroeder, and she's going to go into more detail about some elements of the order that's in front of you today.
Before Angela starts, or while you're switching programs there, a couple other things. Anyway, there's more people standing in the back now. So I see about 9 empty seats down here on this side. I see a couple over here. Maybe you could raise your hand if you have an empty seat next to you, please. There are quite a few. There are probably a dozen seats available if you'd like to sit down. And then for those of you come in later, if we do run out of seats, there's room next door. I missed a couple of staff that I should have introduced. Dave Paradis is seated next to Karen Worcester there. As I mentioned, Karen's our CCAMP program manager, the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. And Dave provides a lot of help in developing that program, maintaining that program. And thanks for assisting, Dave, as always. Seated next to him is Chris Rose of our staff, who is our program manager for and section leader, unit leader for total maximum daily loads, TMDLs. Sorry I missed you the first time. And then another thing I missed is that we had supplemental sheets that we provided for this item. So those are materials that went out after the agenda itself was prepared. I'll just mention what those are. There's one that's dated March 4th. That's a summary of comments and responses. And then it references Appendix E, which was on our website, and it has more detail on the comments and responses. That also included Appendix D, which was the options considered. And then the last part of that same March 4 supplemental sheet had a few corrections that we noted that need to be made to the draft order. And then March 9th, separate supplemental sheet is a memo from Harvey Packard regarding enforcement perspective. So just wanted to mention that those are part of our record of materials today. So Angela Schroeder is up next.
Good morning. My name is Angela Schroeder, and I'm a senior engineering geologist and program manager of the Agricultural Regulatory Program. As Michael mentioned, I'm going to provide you with additional background on staff's recommended draft agricultural order. In my presentation, I will discuss the tiers in the draft order, the tiering criteria, and summarize key order conditions. I will also provide you with an example of how the draft order considers a variety of information and factors to focus on the most important details to best protect water quality, while taking into account water quality priorities, local conditions, and the characteristics of individual farming operations. This is an image of the Central Coast region. Whoops. Sorry. What am I doing here? This is an image of the Central Coast region. There's approximately 435,000 acres of irrigated agriculture, and currently approximately 1,700 farming operations are enrolled in the current agricultural order. A farming operation can have multiple individual farms. The 1,700 farming operations enrolled in the current agricultural order are represented by more than 3,000 individual farms, which are shown here as green dots. Each individual farm has very site-specific characteristics that affect the level of waste discharge and threat to water quality. For example, each individual farm has a different size, setting, and location. In addition, each farm grows different crops, uses different types and amounts of fertilizers and pesticides, employs different types of irrigation, and implements different management practices. The challenge is how to consider these multiple factors, which are unique to individual farms, and best protect water quality. As with any other water board program or general order, the draft order simplifies this complex situation by focusing on the most important details. Early board feedback and public input indicated that individual farming operations are unique, that the requirements should not be one size fits all, and that staff should consider a tiered approach in the draft order. The draft order has 3 tiers. The tiers are based on level of waste discharge and threats to water quality. The draft order includes increased requirements for discharges with the highest level of waste and greatest threat to water quality in the most impaired areas. The draft order also recognizes that there are some dischargers, especially smaller farms, who may present a very low to minimal threat to water quality. In response to the severity and magnitude of water quality conditions in the Central Coast region, the draft order tiers are based on the following five criteria: crops known to have higher nitrate loading impacts, chemicals known to cause significant pollution, for example, chlorpyrifos and diazinon, proximity to an impaired water body or public water system well, discharge to a toxic or pesticide-impaired water body, and size of a farming operation. Tier 1 operations represent the lowest threat to water quality. The Tier 1 criteria include: the operation does not use chemicals known to cause toxicity or pollution in surface waters, such as chlorpyrifos or diazinon. The operation is not located within 1,000 feet of a surface water body impaired for toxicity, pesticides, nutrients, sediment, or turbidity. If growing crops that have a high nitrate loading risk, then the operation must be less than 1,000 acres and not within 1,000 feet of a polluted public well. Alternatively, a vineyard could qualify for Tier 1 if the operation is certified as sustainable in practice. The reason why staff characterizes sustainable in practice certified vineyards as low threat is because the SIP certification requires and verifies implementation of specific management practices that protect water quality. For example, the SIP certification requires a 25-foot buffer along streams and creeks. Tier 2 operations represent a moderate threat to water quality, and the criteria include: the operation uses chlorpyrifos or diazinon, the operation is located within 1,000 feet of a surface water body impaired for toxicity, pesticides, nutrients, sediment, or turbidity. Operations that grow crops that have high nitrate loading risk within 1,000 feet of an impacted public well but are less than 1,000 acres. Tier 3 operations represent an increased risk to water quality, and the criteria include: operations that have crops that have high nitrate loading risk and are greater than 1,000 acres, operations that use chlorpyrifos or diazinon, and that discharge to a surface water body impaired for toxicity or pesticides. So I'm going to provide you with an example. In the next few slides, I will show you specific information to demonstrate how the draft order takes a large number of farms, each with different characteristics, and employs a tiering approach that is both reasonable and responsible given the severity of water quality conditions in the area. The data I will be showing you is from operations in the Lower Salinas area, and it's based upon the information submitted by farmers as part of the recent 2011 electronic notice of intent. In this example, I will focus on toxicity and pesticides to illustrate staff's process in evaluating the threat to water quality and how that process relates to the tiers in the draft order. The process simplifies a complex number of factors by focusing on the most important details that influence water quality. This is an aerial view of the Lower Salinas area. In the middle, you see the city of Salinas. And to the lower left, you see the Salinas River. There are approximately 360 individual farms in this area. And again, in this example, I'm going to focus on the criteria related to toxicity and pesticides. I will take you through a series of questions to illustrate staff's process in evaluating threat to water quality and how that process relates to tiers in the draft order. This is the same area in map view. In the middle, you see the city of Salinas. The rivers and creeks are shown in blue. Salinas River is there towards the bottom. Top left is the Elkhorn Slough in Monterey Bay. The green dots are individual farms. In the Salinas area, in this particular image, there are approximately 360 individual farms. Focusing on toxicity and pesticides, staff asked a series of questions to evaluate which farms pose the greatest threat to water quality and which pose a lesser threat. Or in other words, which farms are a higher priority for the draft order and which are a lower priority? The first question we can ask is which farms pose lower threat to water quality? One way we can evaluate this is by identifying operations that are SIP certified. In this case, there are no vineyards in this area that are SIP certified. Again, focusing on toxicity and pesticides, we can also evaluate how many farms are applying pesticides. In the lower Salinas area, there are 360 farms, and they all apply pesticides. Recognizing that not all pesticides are a threat to water quality, staff further evaluated the extent to which pesticides are found in surface water. As described in the order, more than 75 individual pesticides are found in surface water in the Central Coast region. Staff evaluated the use of these pesticides. In the lower Salinas area, all 360 farms apply at least one pesticide which has been detected in surface water. While many pesticides have been detected in surface water, a few have been documented to be a primary cause of toxicity and impairment, especially chlorpyrifos and diazinon. Staff evaluated the use of these particular chemicals. In the lower Salinas area, 170 of the 360 farms apply chlorpyrifos or diazinon. We can also prioritize farms based upon location. The idea is that a farm that is in closer proximity to an impaired water body is of relatively higher priority compared to a farm that is farther away. In the lower Salinas area, we can evaluate farms that apply chlorpyrifos or diazinon and are within 1,000 feet of an impaired water body. In the lower Salinas area, 22 of the 360 farms apply chlorpyrifos or diazinon and are located within 1,000 feet of an impaired water body. We can also identify farms which may have an increased threat to water quality. In this case, we looked at farms which apply chlorpyrifos or diazinon and drain to a creek that's impaired for toxicity or pesticides. Based on the information submitted with the 2000 electronic NOI related to the use of chlorpyrifos and diazinon, the presence of tailwater, and the identification of discharge points on ranch maps, staff estimates that approximately 10 of the 360 farms would fall into this group. So in summary, in this example of the lower Salinas area focusing on toxicity and pesticides, you can better understand staff's process in evaluating threat to water quality and how that process relates to tiers in the draft order. Similar to other water board programs and general orders, this process simplifies a complex number of factors by focusing on the most important details that influence water quality. In this case, moving from 360 farms to 10 farms to prioritize those farms that are a higher priority for the draft order. So undergoing this evaluation in the lower Salinas area provides us with information to inform tiers. For this area, based on data submitted in the electronic NOI, approximately 151 farms would be Tier 1, 199 farms would be Tier 2, and 10 farms would be Tier 3. Again, this is for the criteria related to toxicity and pesticides. Staff has also done a similar evaluation for the nitrate-related criteria. As Michael mentioned, similar to the analysis of data for the lower Salinas area, this slide summarizes staff's assessment of how the tiers would apply to farming operations region-wide. These numbers are based on information from the electronic notice of intent, the existing enrollment database, county crop maps, and pesticide use information. Staff expects that most operations would fall into Tier 2, which makes sense given that Tier 2 is intended to include those operations that represent a moderate threat to water quality. Tier 3 would include the least amount of operations, representing those that have an increased threat to water quality. Again, as Michael Thomas indicated, this slide summarizes the order conditions. Tier 2 is very similar to the 2004 agricultural order, with additional necessary requirements included to protect groundwater quality and drinking water sources, as well as improved reporting for compliance information via an online system. Tier 1 requirements have decreased reporting, and Tier 3 requirements have increased verification and reporting due to the increased threat to water quality. Now I'm going to focus on specific aspects of the Tier 3 requirements because they could be considered new, while other aspects are more similar to the existing agricultural order. Specifically, I'll discuss Tier 3 individual monitoring, the water quality buffer plan, and the irrigation nutrient management plan. Lisa McCann will talk a little bit more about time schedules in a moment. The draft order requires all Tier 3 dischargers to conduct individual surface discharge monitoring for those farms that have irrigation or stormwater runoff. Given the relative increased threat from Tier 3 operations, the purpose of individual discharge monitoring is to characterize the nature and amount of waste that may affect water quality. Individual surface discharge monitoring includes discharge flow and volume, temperature, pH, electrical conductivity, nitrate, and chlorpyrifos and diazon if they're in use, as well as toxicity. A subset of the Tier 3 operations must also develop and implement an irrigation and nutrient management plan. These requirements apply to the subset of Tier 3 operations that have high nitrate loading risk and only for the relevant individual farms. The proposed nitrate loading risk factors and requirements were developed by staff in consultation with technical experts specializing in the field of vegetable crops, consultants, certified crop advisors, and representatives from the Central Valley region. In addition, the December 3rd proposal submitted by the California Farm Bureau Federation and members of the agricultural community proposes to use the same nitrate loading risk factors. Given the severity of groundwater impacts in the Central Coast region and the high nitrate loading risk from Tier 3 operations, the purpose of the irrigation and nutrient management plan is to minimize nitrate loading to surface water and groundwater. Specific elements of the irrigation nutrient plan include the following. The plan must be certified by a crop advisor or a similarly qualified professional, and it must include standard nutrient budgeting tools, such as the identification of crop needs, reporting total nitrogen applied, and calculating nitrogen balance ratios. I'll talk a little bit more about the nitrogen balance ratios in the following slide, but it's simply the total nitrogen applied divided by the crop needs. The plan must report practices implemented, and it must also estimate nitrate loading to groundwater. In addition, there's also a requirement to verify the effectiveness of the irrigation and nutrient management plan. In addition, Tier 3 dischargers may choose to conduct groundwater monitoring to evaluate nitrate loading as an alternative to the irrigation and nutrient management plan. Again, only a subset of Tier 3 dischargers have to develop and implement the plan, and staff estimates that approximately 30 of the 1,700 currently enrolled operations will have to comply with this requirement, and only for those farms with a high nitrate loading risk. So this is additional detail about the nitrogen balance ratio. The draft order requires Tier 3 dischargers with high nitrate loading risk to achieve specific nitrogen balance ratios. Specifically, the draft order requires a nitrogen balance ratio of 1 for multiple cropping systems like lettuce and a nitrogen balance ratio of 1.2 for annual crops like strawberries. Again, these nitrogen balance ratios were developed in consultation with technical experts and crop advisors. The nitrogen balance ratio is the total nitrogen applied divided by the crop needs. To be clear, a nitrogen balance ratio of 1 is not perfection. It actually recognizes that nitrate loading to groundwater will occur. Crops are not 100% efficient. If you apply exactly what the crop needs to grow, some amount will load to groundwater. Staff's goal is to improve water quality and to take steps toward reducing nitrate loading to groundwater and to maximize water quality improvement over time. These targets help us do that. Now I'm going to show you how this works in a real example. This is a slide presented at a recent 2011 Irrigation and Nutrient Management meeting. It shows data from more than 100 lettuce fields over the past 10 years, specifically seasonal application of nitrogen. Staff has overlaid information onto the slide to apply the requirements of the draft order. Notice the spring planting for lettuce. There's a large range in application of nitrogen in the sample of more than 100 lettuce fields. Here in the left, you see the maximum pounds per acre in the spring planting is 392 pounds per acre, and the minimum is 70. This is a very wide range. Remember that the nitrogen balance ratio is a total nitrogen application over crop needs, and the target for lettuce is 1. Data on crop needs is available for major crop types in the Central Coast region and for lettuce. The crop needs ranges from 120 to 140 pounds per acre. So if we use the data from the study, we can evaluate the range of nitrogen balance ratios for lettuce in the Central Coast region. The wide range in nitrogen application yields a very wide range of nitrogen balance ratios. Remember that the target for lettuce is 1. So in the case of the maximum nitrogen application, the nitrogen balance ratio is 2.8, well over the target of 1. In the case of the minimum nitrogen application, the nitrogen balance ratio is 0.5, well under the target of 1, indicating a much more nutrient-efficient application and reduced nitrate loading to groundwater. If we look at the average of the lowest nitrogen application fields, the average nitrogen balance ratio is 1.5, fairly close to the target. Data from this real example indicates that a target of 1 for vegetables like lettuce is possible, and that many farms likely exceed this target and are loading to groundwater.
I have a question about that, Angela, if I could just inject before it goes further. How is soil type factored into this? I mean, it would seem to me that soil type, how is soil type kind of factored into this? I would think that, you know, let's assume that all farms are trying to be as efficient as possible with their use of nitrogen. And some are using higher amounts because of soil conditions. And that the only way they can get the productivity they want is by using more nitrogen. It looks like then they are going to suffer a consequence because of their soil type, because there's going to be greater nitrogen being discharged to groundwater.
That is correct. That soil type is a factor. The crop needs that you see here for lettuce, the 120 to 140 is a range. It takes into account the various factors that may affect the nitrogen crop needs. The irrigation and nutrient management plan allows a grower to be site-specific in their operation. So they adapt the plan to their specific crop. And in fact, we don't prescribe a crop nitrogen uptake. They determine that themselves. They determine it based upon documentation and literature, their own crop and tissue analysis and other factors. So the point of the plan is for them to determine their crop needs, report the total nitrogen applied, and calculate a nitrogen balance ratio.
But what if they can't achieve that ratio because of their soil type? What is going to happen to them?
Within the irrigation nutrient plan details in the draft order, it specifies that they can provide us with information about their specific crop needs, their nitrogen balance ratio, and to verify that if they exceed the nitrogen balance ratio, how much nitrogen loading that would result. For example, if you exceeded a 1.0, you can provide that information to tell us, this is my nitrogen balance ratio, and I know that nitrate's not loading to groundwater for these various reasons.
Yeah, but what if it is? What if the end result is there are farms that are discharging nitrogen to groundwater? And that's because of the soil type they have and the type of crops that they want to grow on their land. And this is going to result in a discharge to groundwater. I'm not suggesting there shouldn't be some consequence to that if there's a pollutant going to groundwater. I just want to find out what you have in mind in terms of what if they can't achieve that ratio? What happens?
So all this information is submitted to the board into a database, as we talked about earlier. We review that information, and where we see that people or farmers are not meeting this standard, we look at the overall conditions in that area. So if groundwater is polluted in that area and say there are domestic wells in that area, we follow up with that farmer and say, you've got to reduce the loading here, or we'll take additional regulatory action to make sure that you reduce it. So it will depend on the threat that that loading places to water quality and human health, and we'll prioritize those cases.
Additional regulatory action. I don't want to. I guess we won't get into a discussion of that at this point, what you have in mind, but, you know, I would think that before we ever get to that level or stage, that there's a broader discussion of what would be appropriate.
Yes.
I'm not suggesting something shouldn't happen. I'm just concerned about what staff may have in mind as what it thinks is appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, I could maybe add to your answer, the answer to that.
Okay.
The way the non-point source policy works and the way the order, I believe, is set out is that if that is not working, the discharger would need to provide what additional management practices could be imposed to meet the standard. The obligation ultimately is for dischargers to comply with water quality standards. And so it doesn't contemplate there'll be some immediate enforcement, but rather look at what you're doing. Can you improve what you're doing to reduce the impact? And, you know, ultimately, if they don't do that, they could be subject to some kind of enforcement. But basically the approach of the non-point source policy is to improve your practices so that ultimately you're meeting the standards.
Okay. Mr. Jeffries, did you have a comment, question?
Well, it appears with your line of questioning would kind of change, if they couldn't meet the requirements, it would change what type of crop that they would be growing. And I don't know if I'd want to be in that position to dictate to the farmer what crop he should be growing, because that is his livelihood, he or she's livelihood. And then getting back to the soil conditions, and since we're talking about the Salinas lower Salinas Valley, where most of it is west of Salinas itself, which is the people from Salinas would note as a Blanco area, where there's a lot of tiling in that particular area. And we know that there are clay layers in that particular area that nitrate would never reach groundwater because they never get through the clay layers. Now, consequently, the tiling, it would have some runoff. Is that measurement done at the runoff location, the tiling, where it goes into some kind of a drainage? Then my other question would be to follow up of the type of irrigation that would they be using. For instance, in the Blanco area, if you're a strawberry farmer and using drip irrigation and not sprinkler or top water irrigation, is that going to make a difference with the calculation of nitrates being used? I mean, there's a whole gamut of different types of crops. And then how do you determine, I know you're looking at what the ag is providing you, the amount of nitrate that they're providing per acre for their particular crop. But I to touch on some of this, what I started to bring up in February is about Tier 3, where you talked about 1,000-acre farms, where you have a farm operation that might have 200 acres in the Blanco area, 200 acres in the east side, 200 acres Salinas Riverside, and so forth. You're still calculating in that as a 1,000-acre farm. Is that correct from the staff? Or are you looking at those individual farming operations?
Well, I'll get to this in a little bit more detail in a moment. However, in general, the way you get into a tier is by the characteristics of your operation. So you are correct in assuming that if your operation totals up, the ranches total up to more than 1,000 acres, that's correct. And you grow a crop that is have a higher risk of nitrogen loading to groundwater, you would fall into Tier 3. However, the requirements are specific to the ranch. So only your individual ranches that are a high nitrate loading risk would have to develop and implement a plan. And I'll show you an example in a moment. To be clear, the order doesn't dictate what crops can be grown. The goal is to reduce nitrate loading to groundwater. The target of 1 allows us to evaluate the relative load to groundwater. It's a target. So what we know here, like in this example, is there are some operations that have a nitrate balance ratio of almost 3 times that. So the goal is to reduce that nitrate load as evidenced by a nitrate balance ratio. And clearly there are some farms that can do that.
I just wanted to add one thing. The order specifically says in the condition that cites the ratios that the condition is to meet the ratios or an equivalent loading reduction, because a reasonable load reduction so that waste isn't being discharged is what the goal of this is. So these ratios are an indication of a level of loading that represents waste discharge.
Okay. Can I just so what you mean by that is that if you don't meet 1, that's not a number you're going to enforce. It's you're looking at it as a trend or as a goal to reduce loading, not to necessarily meet that number of 1, correct?
Correct. It's an indication of loading to groundwater. And we are not going to look at 1 individual case and the individual loading at that location. We'll look at all of the information that is submitted and the information in a particular area, like the Lower Salinas area, or an area where there are domestic wells. And if we find that the loading in that area is presenting an unacceptable risk to domestic wells, for example, where the concentrations in the domestic wells exceed the drinking water standard, we will prioritize these areas and follow up on those areas. And you said earlier, Mr. Young, that we probably won't get into that. We could get into that, what that additional regulatory action would be. The board has many options for additional regulatory action. We have cleanup abatement orders and cease and desist orders and waste discharge requirements with more comprehensive requirements than what are included here in this 2011 proposed order, and enforcement actions for the conditions in this order. So you have a wide range of additional regulatory action that could be taken, and we would take those actions in cases where it's warranted, where we have the highest risk to water quality and public health. That's a very real part of our work and of this order.
Well, what I would like to happen is that before the staff goes down that line, that we have a discussion at the board level with the public involvement in terms of here's where we're at and this is where we think we need to go. So, and how we're going to get there.
Yes, so, and that would happen because the vast majority of these additional regulatory actions are done by the board, not staff.
That's right, but some of them, and there's quite a few, that happen below the board's involvement, and they just start to take place.
Yes. And
before that happens,
yes,
I'd like there to be a discussion at the board level with the public's involvement so we can just see where we're at, what's the information staff has collected, what have the growers told us. How has staff evaluated that, and what does staff think would be the next step? So I don't want the public, or especially the farming community, to think that staff is going to go down any particular enforcement path at this time until we've had a discussion.
I agree.
Okay.
It's entirely reasonable, and it's what we would normally do. And especially in this case where you have a lot of growers and we have a dynamic situation where we are learning, as well as the growers and the technical support people are learning about this issue, we would be providing the information that is submitted to us to the board as we go along. So we would be providing regular reports to the board on this and explaining to you what we're finding. And then we would have to discuss, but what direction do we go now? If we're not achieving measurable improvement, tangible improvement, which direction do we go in?
Okay.
I also wanted to follow up on one comment that about, let's say there's a particular crop that is being grown and you're unable to stop loading to groundwater. We cannot say, we staff cannot say, it's okay. If you're growing a particular crop, it's okay to load nitrates to groundwater if you can't meet the standard. We cannot say that, we won't say that. It may very well be that farming practices have to change or that certain types of crops have to change in order to meet water quality standards. That's another very real part of our regulation and our oversight. It could happen, and I don't want people to think that it could. That there's no way that could happen. It could happen.
Well, I understand that, and I actually expect staff to do its job and to apply the law, bring to the board what it thinks is something that should be done or changed or modified. I just want to make sure with this particular huge effort that we're undertaking that everyone's well informed about what we're going to do and that there's ample time to discuss options and to consider alternatives. I mean, there's an explanation for why we have a range from 392 to 70 in terms of nitrogen application. And that's a whole discussion in and of itself.
Yes. And
so,
yes.
You know, I the target is fine. I'm not bickering about that. I'm just more looking down the line at what's going to happen when we have people that can't meet that.
Yes. So. And part of that, another part of the picture is, as Mr. Jeffries pointed out, what if there are site-specific conditions that a grower is not meeting the target, but they're not loading to groundwater because of the particular conditions there? Then we would have to consider that, and that grower can submit that information to us in various forms. We would definitely consider that. We would not have an across-the-board opinion that if you're not meeting the target, we're going to take enforcement action. As we do in every case that comes before the board, we have to consider the conditions of each individual case. So where we have areas where our growers are not meeting those standards, we've got to look at the particulars.
Yeah, and Mr. Thomas, I was referring to those enforcement actions that don't come before the board that staff launches into. And I'm not saying it's not done inappropriately. I'm just saying that there are, you know, lower level forms of enforcement that take place that don't come before the board. And so, you know, I'm just making my request known now that we have the discussion before we go down those paths. That's all.
We'll do that.
And I expect staff to do what it's doing. But I expect to have a full blown discussion about these things at that time.
I agree with you, Mr. Chair. The other thing I wanted to point out is, I would say 99% of the farmers that I know all have professional people that advise them how much fertilizers or nitrates to put on their crop. What are we doing to reach out to those professionals to bring them into the area of meeting these requirements? Have we attempted to do that?
There's a whole gamut of technical assistance and research going on about this exact issue. And as I mentioned, this graphic is from a recent meeting that was well attended by certified crop advisors and specialists and consultants like you're describing.
Right.
And this was just in February. So I think as the information becomes more available as research continues to be conducted and assistance continues to be provided, it'll help us to progress towards water quality improvement. So I just have a few more slides.
Go ahead.
So again, staff estimates that 30 out of the approximately 1,700 enrolled growers would have to develop an irrigation nutrient management plan and attempt to achieve these the nitrogen balance ratio targets here. The draft order also requires a subset of Tier 3 dischargers to develop and implement a water quality buffer plan. Again, these requirements would apply to the subset of Tier 3 operations that contain or are adjacent to a water body impaired for sediment, turbidity, or temperature. And given the severity of impacts of discharges to aquatic life, the purpose of the water quality buffer plan is to prevent waste discharge, comply with water quality standards and beneficial uses in compliance with the order and the basin plan.
Can I ask you about the plans? Where are they to be kept? Are they submitted to the staff? Are they online? Are they accessible to the general public?
The buffer plans or the farm plans?
Well, the farm plan, and that could be all kinds of plans.
There's no requirement to submit the farm plan. Okay. Elements of the farm plan, for example, management practices implemented, would be reported on this annual compliance form that Michael Thomas described, and you'd submit online, similar to the electronic notice of intent. The irrigation nutrient management plan is similar. There is no requirement to submit the irrigation nutrient management plan. Again, as part of this online reporting form, you would report on key elements of the plan, for example, your nitrogen balance ratio, the target you achieved, your description of factors influencing the target you achieved, the practices that you're implementing. The water quality buffer plan would be submitted to the water board as written in the current draft order. And let me describe to you some of the elements of that plan. The specific elements of the water quality buffer plan include a minimum of a 30-foot buffer, any increases in buffer width to prevent discharge of waste, a schedule for implementation, maintenance provisions to ensure water quality protection, as well as photo monitoring. In addition, Tier 3 dischargers may choose to propose a more site-specific alternative that is functionally equivalent. Again, only a subset of Tier 3 dischargers have to develop and implement the water quality buffer plan. Staff estimates that approximately 10 of the 1,700 currently enrolled operations would have to comply with this requirement, and only for those farms that contain or are adjacent to a stream impaired for temperature, turbidity, and sediment. So this is one case where a water quality buffer plan would have to, would be submitted. However, we anticipate, as with the other reporting elements that we've described, this plan would also be submitted online through a series either of drop-downs, description boxes, or it could be uploaded as well.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to talk about several letters that I read, and I want to thank everybody that sent about 120-plus letters into us. They're all in this binder that I have right here. Talk about proprietary information and also riparian areas. And is that included in the 30-foot buffer area? No? Yes?
I can answer that. The Water Code specifically provides that if you are requested to submit information that's considered proprietary or trade secrets,
yep,
that it is to be kept confidential by the board. So it will be up to the discharger who's submitting the plan to clearly mark the areas of the plan that are proprietary information so that the board can keep it confidential.
So the board and the staff would have access to that, and it's not online?
Correct. So there would... I don't know how they're proposing to deal with it online, but it would be required to be kept confidential. But the board and the staff is allowed to view it.
What kind of assurances can we give to the ag groups that this confidential information will be kept confidential? as we know, with all the leaks and all these kind of things that our federal government is involved in, how do we know that this information is going to be kept that way? What safeguards do we have?
We would do that similar to any other program that we or set of proprietary information that we currently deal with. And in fact, if we deal with it electronically, it allows us to mark those clearly and to not distribute those publicly. Okay. However, staff would have to make the determination that that actually was proprietary information. So the discharger would tell us, mark those, and then if we would have a discussion about what elements were proprietary and which were not. So,
right. I can just add, typically this is a common situation where people submit proprietary information. The board keeps it confidential, and what we typically do is tell the person who submitted it, we will keep it confidential. If we get a request for this information, a Public Records Act request, we will inform you that we've received the request, and you can assist us and in assuring that what we have to produce publicly is not proprietary, because often they'll mark the entire report as proprietary when it's not. And we, it is an issue because we're required by law to provide public records. And so we have to be sure that we comply with that law to provide public records, as well as to keep information that truly is considered proprietary or trade secrets by law private. So this is not a new issue. It happens all the time, and the staff is prepared to deal with those issues.
Let me make a suggestion about this point. I'd like to make sure that once staff has reviewed what has been marked, by the applicant as proprietary, that staff has had a discussion with the applicant. If you come up with a different determination that, no, this is not proprietary, we intend to release it, if asked, that at least you have a discourse with the applicant and allow them to tell you again why they think it should be kept confidential, and if not, I'd like them to know what is going to be released, if asked.
And
not so that staff gets the information, makes the determination, there's no further exchange with the applicant, but it just gets released somehow.
And the applicant's assuming that it's accepted that way.
Yeah, I want to make sure there's a closed loop on that, if you disagree with the applicant, that the applicant has an opportunity to at least bring that to closure.
And that is the normal process, is to not release the information without having that conversation with the submitter of the information before, and giving that person an opportunity to defend it and say, no, it is proprietary and here's why. And it's extremely rare that it happens, but
in the code?
That's just a practice that the board engages in, because it is required by law to keep it confidential if it truly is confidential. So it's a practice that, I've been the attorney for boards for 23 years, and it's happened twice that we've even engaged in that issue. So it's common to keep it confidential. It's rare to have to deal with the issue of disclosing it. But this does happen.
This is a huge effort.
Right.
Encompassing a lot of people, a lot of acreage, a lot of issues. So
yeah.
I would think that there may be a request for this information.
Right, and so it's important to be clear, and I've advised staff on how to do that.
Mr. Chairman, we would, where there's controversy, if there's a disagreement between us and a discharger, then if there is disagreement between staff and a discharger about confidentiality, we would definitely be talking to the board's counsel about that. We won't make the decisions on our own.
Okay.
I asked a question about the buffer. Can you elaborate on the buffer?
Can you repeat your specific question? Elaborate on.
Well, I was talking about riparian buffers. Is that what you're talking about, the 30-foot buffer, or buffers to be increased?
What she's talking about in general is a requirement to ensure that Tier 3 dischargers that are discharging to an impaired water body for sediment, turbidity, or temperature are ensuring that there are no waste discharges into that stream. A very effective and standard way to do that is to have a vegetated buffer between the edge of the area that has the likelihood of discharging waste, such as a bare field or a row between vegetated crops and the stream that's impaired.
Well, I brought this issue up before because of the requirements of food and ag that are now requiring that they don't have any buffers. How do we, you know, we got two jurisdictions telling these folks two different things. And we're going to say that you're discharging because you don't have some kind of a buffer there. And then you have, on the other hand, Food and Ag is telling them you can't have a buffer because the possible contamination. How are the two agencies working together on this?
And I'm not an attorney on this, but
neither am I, but I'm just asking a question.
There is a conflict, as you pointed out, between food safety issues and requirements or conditions of the board. My understanding of it, not being an attorney, is there isn't a agency requirement or regulation that there be no vegetation or no buffer. There are buyers who have people in the field indicating to farmers that they are reluctant or will not buy produce if there is wildlife in the vicinity of that produce because of the risk involved. And the literature does not support the buyer's or auditor's position that there should be bare ground or no vegetation or no riparian vegetation, that is the greatest risk. The literature shows that domestic cattle and pigs are the largest source of the most problematic bacteria. And that, and we, you know, we've referenced this in our letters to other agencies and in our staff report, where there are reports in the literature that show that removing the vegetation could exacerbate the problem, not improve it, the food safety problem, by allowing the transport of this problematic bacteria. So while there is a conflict between buyers and water board conditions or requirements, we don't see a conflict between requirements of different agencies. So those are two very different things.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear more about that today.
And Mr. Jeffries, just to add to that, the proposed order has submit a buffer plan where you would identify how it is you intend to prevent discharges of waste to waters of the state. If it doesn't work for you to have a buffer, a riparian buffer of 30 feet or whatever, you would need to propose another way because you're still obligated to comply with the basin plan standards of not discharging. And I think what you said was there would be about 10 farms in the out of 1,700 that would be subject to that. So certainly staff would be able to work with those individuals to figure out how to work out the plan with them.
So the minimum 30-foot buffer, that's in conjunction with or any alternative that a farmer could come up with that would accomplish the same end result. So if someone says, you know, I can get something engineered within a 15-foot buffer that'll do the same thing and we can show it to you, that would be acceptable.
That's correct.
Okay.
So to conclude here, the draft ag order takes into account the complexity of irrigated agriculture and the specific characteristics of individual ranches and simplifies the tiering criteria and order requirements by focusing on the most important details to protect water quality. The order is reasonable, and the tiering requirements are scaled based on threat to water quality, similar to all other water board programs. Tier 1 has minimal requirements and will minimize the burden on small farms and those which pose the least threat to water quality. Tier 2 is similar to the 2004 agricultural order and is a reasonable level of requirements for a majority of the farms in the Central Coast region. It includes the necessary reporting of key management practice outcomes and how they are effective. Tier 3 is necessary and responsible given the increased threat to water quality and the severity and magnitude of water quality problems and impacts to public health. And now Lisa McCann will speak to you more about our public input process.
Before Lisa.